This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ground Zero is now a vast hole. The cleanup is nearly complete, but the future of the site is still a big question. My guest, Paul Goldberger, is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. His article in this week's edition is titled Groundwork: How the Future of Ground Zero is Being Resolved. He writes that the rebuilding of Ground Zero has forced us to rethink that section of Manhattan and gives us a chance to fix some of the mistakes that were made at the time the World Trade Center was built. I asked him what mistakes he'd like to see fixed.
Well, the World Trade Center represented really the sort of apotheosis of a certain kind of 1960s planning and design, which you might sum up as saying it believed in replacing the complex, interesting, rambunctious mix of things that constitutes the city and a good, vital urban neighborhood with a huge, dull, big, flat thing. We obliterated a whole section of Lower Manhattan for the 16-block superblock with just two huge, simple, clunky towers dropped on it. So correcting that is one of the things that I think there's already a pretty wide consensus would be a very good thing to do, putting back some sense of the cityscape, a feeling that you could actually heal the city in so doing. Then another one of the things that we hope can be corrected there isn't really a World Trade Center-related mistake, or not totally. There's a whole web of different kinds of transit systems and subways and commuter lines and so forth that come into that area. None of them were ever connected properly. They were built at different times for different purposes. And you could pull all of that stuff together and maybe do a great transit station, like a Grand Central or, if you want, 30th Street Station for Lower Manhattan for the 21st century. And that's a wonderful opportunity as well.
It looks unlikely that another mega skyscraper will be built in the place of the World Trade Center. Why is that unlikely?
I don't think anybody wants to occupy a 110-story building at this moment in our history. And even less likely is the possibility that anybody would want to pay for it. So the bankers who often make the real decisions about what happens in our cities are not going to finance a building like that because they fear too few people would actually want to occupy it. And I think they're probably right. At this point, it would be a building that nobody really wants to have an office 100 stories above the street in precisely that place where this terrible thing happened on September 11th. However, there's a lot of talk now, and I'm very excited about this, that we should try to find some way to heal the skyline in a different way. For those people who were lucky enough not to have lost members of their own family on September 11th, the thing that they seem to have felt most acutely was the loss of the skyline, the sense that the skyline, which is really the icon of New York, was broken and shattered in a way that it had never been in history. And putting back something into the sky, reclaiming the skyline, is a really important mission that I hope can somehow be part of the rebuilding process. What I would like to see happen is a great tower, a broadcast tower, an observation tower that would be a kind of Eiffel Tower of the 21st century and maybe could use our technology now as aggressively as Eiffel used the technology of the 19th century to create a beautiful and very advanced object that became a symbol of that city.
Paul, I know in the age of terrorism, nobody wants to be on the 100th floor in a building on the site of the World Trade Center. But even without that, was the era of wanting to build the tallest skyscraper ever over?
We really hadn't been building super tall skyscrapers, mega skyscrapers, as I call them, for a while. You know, there's only one building in the United States was taller than the World Trade Center, and that's the Sears Tower in Chicago, and it was finished in 1974. Since then, we've kind of lost interest in that. They're not terribly economical buildings to build. They're difficult. They tend to work mainly as icons. And it's not a surprise that the whole business of building super tall buildings moved over to Asia to those places like Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, and Shanghai that are trying very hard to be noticed on the world stage.
The economics of renting a building like that must be really difficult, too.
The economics of running or renting, did you say?
Well, of running and renting, making a building that size function without losing a fortune.
Well, it's difficult. The problem with a super tall building, it isn't the engineering. It isn't getting it built. We've been able to do that for many, many years. We could build 150 stories, 200 stories even. The problem with super tall skyscrapers is once you get above about 80 floors, the necessity of having so many elevators to get people to the top floors means that most of the bottom floors are taken up with all the elevator shafts going to the higher floors. So you're spending an enormous amount of money to put up this incredibly complicated steel or concrete structure to go higher and higher and higher, but you're getting relatively little space because you're using up so much space at the bottom with more and more elevators. And as I said, the sort of calculations that sort of tilt at about 80 stories, and it generally doesn't pay at that point.
Who's in charge now of deciding what the future of the site will be?
In a way, I'm tempted to say nobody's in charge or everybody's in charge. It's enormously complicated right now, the whole question of the future of the site and the politics of it. The person with the most authority is the governor, George Pataki. He created something called the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, which is a state agency charged with overseeing redevelopment there. The Port Authority, which is the bi-state agency shared by New York and New Jersey, which built the World Trade Center and continues to own and control the land, has a great deal of authority also, since they have made it clear they aren't going away. They want to rebuild in some form. They believe it's their land. They're going to defend it. And so they're sticking with it. Because the governor has say over the Port Authority and the governor has say over the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, he's really the person with the most power. Oddly, the mayor has very little power here. It's mostly a state-controlled piece of land. It's a curiosity because people associated the events around Ground Zero so intimately with Mayor Giuliani because during the weeks following the terrible events of September 11th, he did oversee most of the cleanup and rescue work because that was done by city employees, by the fire department and the police department, which reported to the city. But the future, in a way, belongs to the state, not the city.
My guest is Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Paul Goldberger, is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. We're talking about his article in this week's edition titled Groundwork, How the Future of Ground Zero is Being Resolved. After the Oklahoma City federal building bombing, the families of people who died had a lot of say in deciding what the memorial to the people who died would be. And I think that a lot of the families of people who died in the World Trade Center attack want that same type of participation. Can you compare the two, what happened in Oklahoma
Sure.
City and what families are hoping for now?
Well, Oklahoma City is the most comparable thing in American history, certainly recent American history, to September 11th. But in fact, it doesn't really offer us nearly as much help as we might think. It was a tiny event by comparison. 168 people died as opposed to nearly 3,000. It was a small site, and it was an easy matter to devote the entire site to a memorial. The only possible thing that might have happened in Oklahoma City along with a memorial would have been a new federal building. But the federal government said it was perfectly happy to build its new building a block or two down the street. Didn't matter. There was plenty of land. What did they care? So the entire site was turned over as a memorial. And there was great pressure from the families of those who died to become not just involved, but to really run the process. And in Oklahoma City, there was a key moment when a man named Robert Johnson, who was a very distinguished local lawyer who'd been put in charge of the whole thing by the mayor, was asked by the families to guarantee that they would have the majority of the votes in a jury that would determine a memorial. And he agreed to let them do that, which infuriated one of the men who had been hired as their professional advisor, saying that who essentially said it will mean nothing but kitsch and we will have, you know, terrible memorials of, you know, statues of angels and things like that, and nothing that has real dignity to it, and it will be sentimental and trite. And he walked off. In fact, things didn't turn out so badly, in part because in Oklahoma City they were smart enough to have created a series of guidelines in advance that assured that the memorial would have a certain amount of dignity and not be hopelessly maudlin. In New York, though, we have a much, much tougher situation, and I don't see how we can work within the process they used in Oklahoma City. We've got to have an ongoing part of the city there. It's almost impossible to imagine that the entire site could or should be devoted to a memorial. Not only would it create a void in the center of one of the busiest business districts in the world, it would, in a way, allow that site to belong in perpetuity to the terrorists. We think that leaving it all empty honors those who died, but in a strange and unintentional way, it also gives control of the site to the terrorists. And if you think that what the terrorists were trying to do was destroy the ongoing life of New York, and indeed the ongoing commercial life of America, then building that back on this piece of land is, in fact, one of the most appropriate responses that we can make.
You've mentioned a couple of designs for a memorial that would be incorporated into office buildings. What are some of the other memorial designs that you've heard that would stand independent?
So far, there have only really been a few pure memorial ideas. I think the people who are the most thoughtful, such as Maya Lin, who designed the Great Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, are not rushing. In fact, Maya Lin was asked what she thought we needed at the World Trade Center, and her answer was time. She said, let's wait. Let's not do anything too quickly. And I think she's right. I think we do better when we absorb an event of this enormity over time and think about it. Most of the designs that people rushed into in those first couple of months were not terribly good. They were honest outpourings of emotion and passion and feeling at a terrible time, but I don't know that they would have really solved the problems that we need to have solved. I mean, a huge statue of a fireman is a lovely idea, but is it really what we want to see in the middle of Lower Manhattan? I'm not sure. I haven't yet seen the memorial that feels right to me other than the idea of a great tower. But I think that's fine because, in fact, the sort of call to the international community of architects to begin thinking about it and submitting ideas hasn't really even officially gone out. Everything that's been talked about has been kind of self-generated and is a little too soon.
You wrote in The New Yorker that you hope that whatever is done, it incorporates shards and pieces of steel and twisted remnants of the face of the World Trade Center.
Yes, I would love to see that happen. There's a great power to ruins. We don't always think about that in this country because we have such a short history. We don't have a lot of ruins. We've been lucky enough not to live through much war here, and we don't have cathedrals going back to the Middle Ages. We don't have thousand-year-old buildings. We don't have a lot of ruins. In fact, ruins can give a kind of resonance to a city that's very, very deep. And I think nothing would be better than to see the pieces of the facade that were saved. They're not there now, but they've been, in fact, preserved and dismantled, and they're being stored, re-erected there as a reminder of what was, and that sort of twisted, broken aspect which tells you so much. And there's an authenticity to the power of ruins that, particularly today, in an age of the virtual, when we're so unaccustomed to seeing things that are real, I think the power of the real object can be very, very convincing and meaningful.
While you've been keeping up with the plans for a memorial and for office space in the site of the World Trade Center, have you been also seeing a lot of, like, kitsch memorial? I mean, stuff whose heart is in the right place, maybe, but it's just kind of really tacky.
Well, there was a lot of that proposed for Oklahoma City, and there's been a certain amount of that here. Happily, though, a lot of the impulses toward that have been deflected into the sort of private memorials people have done on the walls, the fences, the mementos, those where people put messages or objects or relics and things like that. And that those things collectively really become a kind of great work of public art and have a and transcend the kitschiness about them. It's a delicate business. Everything about it is very delicate, you know, because there were those who objected to the viewing platform that was created for the public off-Broadway so that people could actually stand there and observe the site, thinking it was ghoulish and vulgar. And in some ways, it sort of is, and yet people also want to bear witness to history. And most people come to it, I think, with the right earnest, honest impulse to stand there in tribute and to look as a means of respect, not ghoulishness. It isn't like people who think it's funny to watch an execution or something. I think people are coming after the fact out of respect, and most people have come in the right spirit. But of course, it's a very fine line, and I understand why to some people, particularly some family members, it has seemed to be over the line to do anything at all. It's tough for these people. Not only has their entire life and family life been turned upside down, but it's been in such a horrendously public way. And they have no place to go that's theirs, no private place. The site belongs to everybody, which, in as we've been saying, is in some ways a good thing. It's created an enormous outpouring of passion. But for those people who lost husbands or wives or children, how do they feel different and more marked than you and me? We all have a stake in 9/11 and that piece of land, but do the people who lost their family members have a greater stake? They certainly have a greater level of feeling, and they have a greater right to feeling and passion than we do. Whether they therefore also have a greater stake in the land going forward is a tough question, and that's going to be one that nobody wants to address head on. I think the political forces are sort of sidestepping it as delicately as possible, because nobody wants to say, yes, they have a greater stake in the future of that land than the rest of us do, but nobody wants to say no either.
Well, Paul Goldberger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Paul Goldberger is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. His article about the future of Ground Zero is in the current edition. This is Fresh Air.